I thought about it for a while and then made a suggestion which caused her to cry out with pleasure. As if to endorse what I had said, the prince broke resounding wind once more. The very next day, when Pharaoh came to visit his son, the queen put my suggestion into effect. "Dear and divine husband, have you given thought to selecting official tutors for Prince Memnon?" Pharaoh laughed indulgently. "He is still only an infant. Should he not first learn to walk and talk before he is instructed in other skills? I think his tutors should be appointed now so they can grow to know him, and he them." "Very well," the king smiled, and took the child onto his knee. "Who do you suggest?" "For his schooling we need one of our great scholars, some person who understands all the sciences and mysteries." The king's eyes twinkled. "I cannot think of one who answers that description," and he grinned at me. The child had altered Pharaoh's disposition. Since Memnon's birth he had become almost jovial, and for a moment I expected him to wink at me. However, his new congenial attitude to life did not extend quite that far. The queen continued, unruffled by this exchange. "Then we need a soldier well versed in the warlike arts and the exercise of arms to train him as a warrior. He should, I think, be young and of good breeding, trustworthy, of course, and loyal to the crown." "Who do you suggest for that position, my dear? Very few of my soldiers answer to all those virtues." I do not think there was any guile or malice in Pharaoh's question, but nevertheless my mistress was no fool. She inclined her head gracefully and said, "The king is wise and knows who from all his generals best suits that role." At the very next assize, the king announced the prince's tutors. The slave and physician Taita would be responsible for Memnon's schooling and deportment. This surprised very few, but there was a buzz of comment when the king went on, "For his training in arms and in military tactics and strategy, the great lion of Egypt, Lord Harab, shall henceforth be responsible." Accordingly, it became the duty of Lord Harab, when he was not on campaign, to wait upon the prince at the beginning of each week. While my mistress waited for her quarters in the new palace that I was building across the river to be completed, she had moved from the harem into the wing of the Grand Vizier's palace that overlooked the water garden I had built for her father. This was in accordance with her new status as the senior wife and consort. The weekly audience that Prince Memnon held for his official tutors took place under the Barazza, with Queen Lostris in attendance. Very often there was a score of other officials or courtiers present, and occasionally Pharaoh himself arrived with all his train, so we were under considerable constraint. However, once in a while there were just the four of us present. On the very first occasion that we had such privacy, Queen Lostris placed the prince in his father's arms for the first time, and I was witness to the incoherent joy with which Thanos looked down into the face of his son. Memnon rose to the occasion by puking down the front of his father's uniform, but even then Thanos would not relinquish him. From then onwards we reserved any special event in the child's life for when Thanos was with us. Thanos fed him his first spoonful of gruel, and the prince was so startled by this unaccustomed fare that he screwed up his face and spat the offending mess down his chin. Then he howled loudly for his mother's milk to wash the taste from his mouth. Queen Lostris took him on her lap, and while Thanos watched fascinated, she gave him the breast. Suddenly Thanos reached across and tweaked the nipple from the tiny mouth. This amused everybody but the prince and me. Memnon was outraged at this cavalier treatment, and made that fact known, while I was shocked. I imagined the king arriving unexpectedly to find the great lion of Egypt with a right royal handful, which he seemed in no hurry to relinquish. When I quite rightly protested, my mistress told me, "Don't be such a prim old woman, Taita. We're only having a little innocent fun." "Fun, yes. However, there is some doubt as to the innocence of it," I muttered, for I had seen both their faces light up at the intimate touch, and sensed their mutual passion like thunder in the air. I knew that they could not restrain themselves for much longer, and that even Thanos' sense of duty and honour must in the end succumb to so great a love as theirs. That very evening I visited the temple of Horus and made a generous sacrifice. Then I prayed and asked the god, "May the prophecy of the mazes be not too long delayed, for they cannot help themselves. It will mean death and disgrace to all of us. Sometimes it is best for men not to attempt to interfere with destiny. Our prayers can be answered in ways which we do not expect and do not welcome. I was physician to the prince, but in truth he had little need of my medical skills. He was blessed with his father's rude and abundant health and precocious strength. His appetite and digestion were exemplary. Anything placed in his mouth was devoured with leonine voracity, and promptly re-emerged from his nether end in the desired shape and consistency. He slept without interruption, and woke bellowing for food. If I showed him a finger, he would watch it move from side to side with those huge dark eyes, and the moment it came within range, he would seize it and attempt to haul himself into a sitting position. In this he succeeded sooner than any other child that I had attended. He raised himself and crawled at the age when others had only begun to sit up. He took his first tottering step when others would only begin to crawl. Tanus was present on that remarkable day. He had been on campaign for the past 2 months, for the forces of the Red Usurper had captured Asyut. That city was the pivot on which our northern defences turned, and Pharaoh had ordered Tanus downriver with all his fleet to retake the city. Much later, I heard from Kratos just how terrible had been the fighting, but in the end, Tanus breached the walls and was at the head of his beloved Blues when they broke in. They drove the pretender from the city and back beyond his own borders with bloody losses. Tanus sailed back to Thebes and the gratitude of the kingdom. Pharaoh laid another chain upon his shoulders, the gold of valour, and made up the back pay of all the troops who had helped him achieve this victory. Tanus came almost directly from the king to the Baratza in the water garden where we were waiting for him. While I stood guard at the gateway, Tanus and my mistress embraced with all the fire that had burned up so brightly when they had been apart. At last I had to separate them, for that embrace could lead in only one direction. "Lord Tanus," I called sharply, "Prince Memnon grows impatient." Reluctantly they drew apart, and Tanus went to where the infant sprawled naked on a robe of jackal skins that I had spread for him in the shade. Tanus went down on one knee before him. "Greetings, Your Royal Highness. I bring you tidings of the triumph of our arms," Tanus mocked him lovingly. And Memnon gave a happy shout as he recognized his father, and then the sparkling gold chain caught his eye. With a mighty heave, he hoisted himself to his feet. He took four lurching steps, seized the chain, and clung to it with both hands. All of us applauded this feat, and supporting himself by the chain, Memnon beamed about him, accepting this praise as his due. "By the wings of Horus, he has as sharp an eye as you do for the yellow metal, Taita," Tanus laughed. "It is not the gold that draws him, but the winning of it," my mistress declared. "One day he too will wear the gold of valour upon his chest." "Never doubt it." Tanus swung the boy high, and Memnon shrieked with pleasure and kicked his legs to urge Tanus to further rough play. Thus, for Tanus and me, the child's advances seemed to mark the change of seasons, just as surely as did the rise and fall of the river. On the other hand, my mistress's life revolved around those hours spent alone with the child and the man. Each interval between Tanus' visits seemed too long for my mistress to support, each visit too short for her to bear. The inundation of that summer was as benevolent as any that we had forecast at the ceremony of the waters in Elephantine. When the flood receded, the fields glistened under their new coat of black mud. In their turn, they were soon obliterated by the dense green stands of corn and fruit. By the time the prince took his first upright step, the granaries of Egypt were brimming, and the larders of even the poorest of her subjects were filled. On the west bank, the palace of Memnon was taking shape, and the war in the north was running in our favour. The gods smiled on Pharaoh and all his realm. The only discontent in all this was that the two lovers, though close enough to touch, were cleaved apart by a gulf wider than the valley in which we lived. Each of them, on separate but numerous occasions, taxed me with the prophecy of the mazes of Amun-Ra, as though I were personally responsible for the fulfilment of the dream visions. It was in vain to protest that I was merely the mirror in which the future was reflected, and not the one who moved the stones, on the bow board of destiny. The old year died, and the river began to rise once more, completing the endless cycle. This was the fourth flood that the mazes had foretold. I, as much as any of them, expected my vision of the mazes to be fulfilled before the end of the season. When this did not happen, both my mistress and Tunnels taxed me severely. "When will I be free to go to Tunnels?" Queen Lostris sighed. "You must do something, Taita." "It is not me, but the gods whom you must question. I can pray to them, but that is all I can do." Then another year passed without any change in our circumstances, and even Tunnus was bitter. "So much faith I have placed in you, that I have based my future happiness on your word. I swear to you, Taita, that if you do not do something soon..." He broke off and stared at me. The threat was all the more forceful for not being spoken. Yet another year drifted past, and even I began to lose faith in my own prophecy. I came to believe that the gods had changed their minds, or that what I had seen was my own wishful fantasy. In the end, Prince Memnon was almost 5 years old and his mother 21 when the messenger came flying, wild-eyed from the north, in one of our scouting galleys. "The Delta has fallen. The Red Pretender is dead. The Lower Kingdom is in flames. The cities of Memphis and Avaris are destroyed. The temples are burned to the ground and the images of the gods thrown down," he shouted to the king. And Pharaoh replied, "It is not possible. I long to believe this dispatch, but I cannot. How could this thing come to pass without our knowledge? The usurper was possessed of great force. For more than 15 years we have been unable to overthrow him. How has this been accomplished in a day, and by whom?" The messenger was shaking with fear and exhaustion, for his journey had been onerous, and he knew how the bearers of disastrous tidings were treated in Thebes. "The Red Pretender was destroyed with his sword still in the scabbard. His forces were scattered before the war trumpets could sound the alarm. How was this accomplished? Divine Egypt, I know not. They say that a new and terrible enemy has come out of the east, swift as the wind, and no nation can stand before his wrath. Though they have never seen him, our army is in full retreat from the northern borders. Even the bravest will not stay to face him." "Who is this enemy?" Pharaoh demanded. And for the first time we heard the fear in his voice. "They call him the Shepherd King, the Hyksos." Tunnels and I had jested with that name. We would never do so again. Pharaoh called his war council into secret conclave. It was only long afterwards that I learned from Kratos all that had transpired in those deliberations. Tunnus, of course, would never break his oath of secrecy, not even to me or my mistress, but I was able to worm it out of Kratos, for that lovable, brawling oaf was not proof against my wiles. Tunnus had promoted Kratos to the rank of best of 10,000, and had given him the command of the Blue Crocodile Guards. The bond between them was still as solid as a granite stele. Thus, as a regimental commander, Kratos was entitled to a seat on the war council, and although at his lowly rank he was not called upon to speak, he faithfully relayed all that was said to me and my mistress. The council was divided between the ancients, headed by Nembet, and the new blood, of which Tunnus was the leader. Unfortunately, the final authority lay with the old men, and they forced their archaic views upon the others. Tunnus wanted to draw our main forces back from the frontier and to set up a series of deep defences along the river. At the same time, he intended sending forward scouting and reconnaissance parties to assess and study the nature of the mysterious enemy. We had spies in all of the northern cities, but for some unknown reason no reports from them had yet been received. Tunnus wanted to gather these in and study them before he deployed his main force to battle. "Until we know what we are facing, we cannot devise the correct strategy to meet it," he told the council. Nembet and his faction countered any of Tunnus' suggestions. The old admiral had never forgiven Tunnus for his humiliation on the day he saved the royal barge from destruction. His opposition to Tunnus was based on principle rather than on reason or logic. "We will not yield a cubic of our sacred soil. To suggest it is cowardice. We will meet the enemy and destroy him wherever we find him. We will not dance and flirt with him like a gaggle of village maidens." "My lord," roared Tunnus, incensed by the suggestion of cowardice, "only a fool, and an old fool at that, will make a decision before he knows the facts. We have no scrap of intelligence to act upon." It was in vain. The seniority of the three generals above Tanus on the army lists prevailed in the end. Tanus was ordered north immediately to steady and rally the retreating army. He was to hold the frontier and make his stand on the boundary stones. He was forbidden to make a strategic withdrawal to the line of hills before Asyut, which was the natural defensive line, and from which the city walls provided a second line of defense. He would have the fleet and the Northern Army Corps under his direct command, with 300 warships to provide the transport and to command the river. In the meantime, Nembet would bring in the rest of the army, even those regiments on the southern border with Kush. The black threat from the African interior must be ignored now in the face of this more pressing danger. As soon as they were assembled, Nembet would rush these reinforcements northwards to join up with Tanus. Within a month, there would be an invincible army of 60,000 men and 400 galleys lying before Asyut. In the meantime, Tanus must hold the frontier at all costs.